Welcome to No Password Required. I'm your host, Jack Clabby, a cybersecurity attorney at Carlton Fields, PA. And with me is...
Kaylee Melton, the Executive Director of Operations at the Cognitive Security Institute and the Bob Ross of InfoSec.
We just finished a great conversation with Rob Hughes. Rob is the Chief Information Security Officer at RSA. Kaylee, what stood out to you the most?
Well, I have to say, I learned a lot today. Specifically, it was nice to get it cleared up as to whether it's CISO or CISO. I believe that it is CISO, according to Rob.
This is it. We're establishing it today and for all time, which is really, really important.
It is. It's very important. I feel like this day might go down in history.
Rob also shares with us, you know, the vision and how close we are to a passwordless future. It's built into the name of the podcast, Kaylee. It's built into the name of the podcast. Mm-hmm. All right. You heard a little bit about what Kaylee and I took away from the discussion. Now let's hear what Rob has to say.
Welcome to No Password Required, a podcast dedicated to showcasing the top personalities in the world of cybersecurity.
Welcome back. Our guest today is Rob Hughes. Rob, welcome to No Password Required.
Thanks. Thank you for inviting me. You know, I love the title of the show.
No, we're going to ask about the passwordless future, Rob, for sure. That's where we all want to be headed. We want to get started, though, a little bit about your current role as the CISO at RSA. I mean, when Kaylee and I were thinking about it, it's sort of like being the chef at a chef's convention, right? Like, what's it like being the security lead at a company of security experts?
Well, I think it can certainly be a little bit intimidating. You know, there's so many different aspects of security, different specialties. You know, our focus is identity, which is like one kind of specific area. So there's a lot of expertise in that within the company for sure, and a lot of broad-based capabilities. But I kind of go back to that old adage, if you hire people that are smarter than yourself. So the good thing is I have a lot of smart people around that, you know, we can talk about things if we get stuck or need some more opinions.
Do like conversations you have about identity management, do they go more easily at RSA because you guys have sort of solved it? Or do you think they're more challenging because everyone has to weigh in?
I think it's absolutely more challenging because there are so many thoughts and, you know, so many sort of opinions around, you know, ordering of things. It's sort of like back in more of the IT days, thought like some of the hardest discussions we had were around like naming conventions. It's like you'd think that would be straightforward, but it's like, you know, all the servers, everything's working great, but that naming convention, like, just, you know, people get fist fights over that sometimes. So.
It's not just, you know, named after Sylvester Stallone movies and just go with that.
No, or planets, you know, the usual suspects.
And how do you balance, like, you know, the parts of your job now that are, you know, securing the internal enterprise against that responsibility for making sure that the products are working right and are securing people? Like,
yeah, it's kind of a, I won't say unique because there's other people that work at other security companies, but it's kind of a neat, like, kind of juxtaposition of those things, because you're trying to secure your corporate and dev environments. Then you have your product too. So we're doing all of that, but I kind of think of it as this triangle, where it's like at the top of the, you know, you have your product and your corporate, and at the very top, the thing that kind of links them together is using your own tools and the corporate environment. So you get this kind of nice feedback loop of like, hey, that's not working for us too well and the security team. So it's probably not working for other customers as well also. And so we get a nice feedback loop going. So it's kind of fun in that respect.
It is like back to the chef metaphor. It's like if you know, you know, if you're running a fast food company and no one's eating the food, it's probably a sign, but you got to make sure that you're doing it, that people want to enjoy that product. Rob, I understand that at some point you, during your RSA tenure, you were the acting CISO before you were the CISO, right? Did having that, like, how did that built-in transition work? And do you think that was, you know, was that helpful for you settling into the full-time role?
I think it was definitely helpful. You know, before I was acting CISO, I was reporting to the CISO. So I was really focused on like the cybersecurity side of things. But I had a pretty good compliance background. I kind of think of those like the two big halves sometimes of the CISO role. And you know, I had been shielded from a lot of the compliance stuff at the corporate level. So once I kind of got into that acting space, it was like, okay, now I'm getting more exposed to some of those things. So it kind of gave me a time to like get a bit more involved in that stuff. You know, you always get the responsibility, or oftentimes you get the responsibility before you get the job role. So I viewed it as a positive thing, although I'd be happy if it went a little faster, but yeah. It's all right.
Robert, I imagine you learned a fair amount, you know, coming up to this role. Are there any lessons that's, you know, something you learned the hard way maybe that still sticks with you today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like trying to go, you know, like even kind of further back, like just, you know, I used to be more technical, hands on the keyboard, and you know, I would kind of lead some teams and things. But then I got to that scary spot where it was like, hey, do you want to, you know, maybe you should manage, or maybe I should be a manager. So it's sort of that transition. Like I really learned, like, hey, not everyone has, you know, works like me. You know, not everyone, you know, has the same work ethic. Not everyone has the same opinions. So there's a lot of differences you get when you're managing people. And you realize like, okay. And also just, you know, it's just sometimes your communication, like you're expecting, well, I can communicate with myself really well. I know what I want to do, but to like express that to others, like, okay, now you need to bring that understanding to them. And just remember there is some executive somewhere in my career at some meeting, and he said, you know, I have to tell, how many times do I have to tell people something before it like sticks and registers with them? And he said, four times. He's like, got to tell them four times. And I definitely talk to technical folks that if they tell you something once and you didn't get it, they're not going to be happy with you. So it's kind of like bridging that gap a little bit is fun.
So you co-founded Geek.com early in your career, and that kind of gave you early credibility in the tech world. How do you think that visibility shaped your career trajectory?
Yeah, so it was certainly an interesting time. You know, I started it with two brothers, Joel Evans and his brother Sam, and it was really the three of us were the ones that kind of, you know, kind of ran it and got that together. And I was the one that was always on the technical side, like making sure that everything ran. So you know, getting the servers, you know, we didn't have the cloud so much. Hey, buy the server and put it into a data center and make sure it runs 24/7, and you get to withstand the attacks from all the internet. Like, yeah, we're going to try to log your SSH server, you know, 10,000 times tonight, and your log file is going to get really big and all that fun stuff. So, you know, I think we were kind of like somewhere in the medium to small size of some of those tech news giants, that some of them are still around today. Like you see Ars Technica and like Slashdot. Like we, you know, they probably knew of us a little bit at the time, but we got that great name, Geek.com. We started out with New Geek because someone else owned Geek.com, but it turned out the person that owned Geek.com was like a town over from where we live. So we were able to kind of get a little rental agreement going and say, hey, wow, how much could we get from you? And, you know, and the guy who owned it worked for, you know, big publishing company that's still around, and like he got it as like a gag gift at some sort of event they had. So And today, strangely, they own the name again. But after we sold it, it went like four hands. And so don't look at it today and think of me, please. It's a... But, you know, just from the technical chops, like, I think I learned a lot, like, kind of having to keep something available 24/7. And being the sole person responsible for that, you know, I think it kind of served me well. I mean, I had some background in that on the IT side. I think writing about technology every day does give you some, some credibility in the space, you know, for better or for worse, depending on how good your writing is. But I think it was always something I could kind of mention back to people, like, hey, you know, I was involved in this, and it's, you know, it's a fun name. It's like, you know, I don't know if you guys know what a geek used to be or not. I'd be happy to meet you, but it was this guy at a circus. If you think of sort of the old freak shows in the 1910s, way back then, they would like bite the heads off of chickens. So that was where the name came from. Kind of gross. Sorry, but yeah. You know, but then it came to mean like someone who's like obsessed with technical piece of things, like, and it was cooler than nerd, I'll always say. For it. No,
I agree.
That would be a fun story, just to trace how it got from the original meaning of geek to the current one, right? Just so different. Exactly. Not the
same. Yeah. I think it was like someone started saying technology geek, and it sort of meant, I think, someone that was just like kind of obsessed and maybe focused, like maybe think of someone a bit more introverted, like you're just like, you know, so hyper focused on this thing. But
yeah,
it was interesting, like techno geek or technology geek. I think that's kind of how it got started.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about what it was like back in the early days of the internet. What was it like launching a startup during that time period, one of the wildest moments in the internet's history?
Yeah, no, it was pretty fun, and we were self-funded. So we, I left my job to kind of run with it at one point. And I just remember trying to budget out, like, okay, my money will last this long for rent, and like might have to eat like McDonald's more often and things like that, like were going through my head. And I was like, yeah, let's see how deep my credit card debt goes. And that's kind of like probably common for a lot of startups even today. But, you know, some of the crazy stuff around the dot-com boom was, you know, if you went to try to get money from an investor, you know, we had these different conversations. Like we ended up just staying self-funded, but we talked to some angel investors, and they were, you know, very skeptical of everything. So they had smaller chunks of money to put in. Like, I don't see how you guys are going to make money. You know, so what's in this for me? And you talk to like the bigger investors, or like the people that would help get the bigger investors. Like, okay, you need a business plan, and the business plan should ramp up within 3 years to $60 million in revenue. And that was in the 2000s, you know, so, and it's right. Really? Like, okay, I can do
it. Purchase newer tickets.
Starting out of our little like tech news business. Like it was a little nuts. And then, you know, we ended up selling the business, but we also got offers like that varied pretty wildly. And, you know, there was one early offer that was like all cash and we weren't ready to sell. And we always looked back at that. We're like, oh, maybe we should have taken that. So up, you know, we were making like, you're at some point through that process, we were kind of working, you know, that plus our other jobs. And we had a lot of, you know, other folks kind of managing it part time and writers and things. And so it was a nice supplemental income.
Thinking about the early days of the internet, let's move to the future. And so RSA's big goal, or one of RSA's big goals, is to have a world without passwords. Why is that so important? And are we actually close to seeing a world like that?
Yeah. So I'd say a few thoughts. Like, I think we're closer than ever. So the first digital passwords came about in, like, I think it was the 1960s. There was like MIT's technology lab where they, maybe even like 1961, if I remember. You know, and immediately once those were released, it's like people printed out, like, here's all the names and passwords, and they you know, start into stuff. So we still have those challenges like today. And it was kind of shocking. Like last year we saw, there's a big storage company called Snowflake. It's widely published, so I'm not trying to talk bad about them, but they had a good practice for multi-factor authentication. Like they had it available, but they didn't require it of their customers. So a lot of the customers were like, nah, that's hard. You know, you turn that, you know, we don't want to turn that on. There turned out to be huge amounts of password spraying attacks and things where people were able to use like cracked passwords to get into those storage accounts. And it caused a lot of mess for a while back in 2024. And I think some of the, like there, I think that was kind of like a realization point or tipping point, a little bit of like, hey, we really need like secure vaults here. Like MFA is required now. Great. But like, hey, what's beyond that? Because you still have what I call, I think of as password risk, that, hey, if MFA ever gets disabled or you fall back to some authentication mechanism, which, you know, is possible in different scenarios, that, hey, that password becomes like what you're reliant on. So we're looking at, and you know, we're typically selling to enterprises, not so much on the consumer side, but we see what goes on the consumer side. And like, really, like you look at the giant big companies, you know, big platforms like Microsoft and Google, like they're really like jumping into password lists and passkeys, you know, for the FIDO Alliance. And there's, you know, they've given examples of having millions or even billions sometimes of these passkeys in use, which is great. But I think still a lot of the smaller systems and things rely on passwords, and you can't trust the user to not share the same password across all their platforms or something pretty close even. So when we look at that, we said, well, look, the big, to eliminate that password risk quickly, going to FIDO passkeys, great, they're phishing resistant, but to get, just to get away from password risk, to go passwordless first, is kind of a step in evolution for a lot of enterprises, because enterprises have a lot of these little identity silos all over the place, technical debt, and it's hard to manage all of that and to bring everything along at the same speed as like one of the big tech giants could be like, hey, we're going to switch over next week. You guys all have to agree to hit that button. Okay. You know, that works in some cases, but a lot of times it's more nuanced in the enterprise space.
What do you think is the tipping point for mass adoption of a passwordless ecosystem?
So I think we're sort of at it, or we've hit it. Like I think I always go back to that, the Snowflake incidents and the, you know, for the highlighting that sort of bringing this like risk of passwords back to the forefront. And then the huge push towards phishing resistant FIDO passkeys right now happening with consumers. So like, if you think of it, like, all right, like my parents or my grandparents, like could, you know, might know what a passkey is now. Like we're getting closer to that. So I feel like we're at the beginning of the tipping point. Like I think, you know, if you think of the lifespan of passwords, like, you know, at least electronic ones goes back to the 60s. So we've got like 60 plus years of these things. So the tipping point's going to be, you know, spread out a bit as well. I think it won't just be one thing. It'll be a bunch of enabling technologies that are now there, like using nowadays everyone has a smartphone and it can do facial recognition. And now the smartphone makers are requiring that it actually, is in place by default in most cases. So you can start to rely on things like that to, you know, to augment your, and to create the space for passwordless in your ecosystem. So that's what a lot of enterprises are doing. That's how we do it. You know, we use those more like to join, you know, standards and technology and push on those standards.
We've talked about a bunch of different facets of what your career path has been like, and I'm sure we haven't touched on everything even. It certainly has included a lot of unique roles, we'll say. Which one do you feel has demanded the most ongoing learning, whether that's formal or informal?
Well, for me, I think it's definitely the security space. Like that's easily like the space I would go and you know, essentially like this role and the roles before. So I've been at RSA about 10 years and I've been in the security space at RSA most of that time, like covering that. And I've had roles before that I work in the security space. I had security teams, but I was always straddling somewhere between IT and security. So, you know, some of these, the security certifications, I mean, now there's literally hundreds of them out there. So, but it's like, there's some core ones like CISSP and CISM, and those require a lot of like rigor and study to understand the space. So I think that requires, you know, for me, it was like, you know, I didn't get into a ton of IT training. I kind of learned on the job for a lot of that stuff. But with security, it's like, hey, you know, this is kind of like, I finally picked this a bit of a specialty. So like, let's kind of dig in and learn that. And, you know, I was formally trained in computer science, but back then that was like algorithms and programming languages. So
there
wasn't a cybersecurity course at Brandeis University. You know, it's like, there are now, but that, yeah. Like, hey, just computer science and, you know, you figure it out. Yeah.
The computer science is like, you know, it's like learning how to like pen science, right? Like here's how a pen works, but it doesn't tell you always what to write with it to some degree, right?
Yeah. Like I always think it's like going to a high-end law school where they're like, hey, you can read these books on like the theory of law from the 1860s and now go to court and like eat a parking ticket. So you could, you have to like learn how to apply all that stuff.
What are the jobs, Rob, that you had was with Philips Home Monitoring? And I just don't know if it gets any more like, you know, life critical, zero failure in terms of an environment. What was that like? And how did that stress stack up to other roles you've had?
Yeah, well, it was definitely a different feel. And it's like, I think about that sometimes, like, all right, you know, you have these kind of financial critical roles that when I joined RSA, we had a few companies together, kind of separated a bit from when we started. But one of them was really focused on financial transactions and fraud detection, a company now called Outsier. I had a lot of great learning there on the compliance side, dealing with PCI and credit cards, and thinking about, hey, this doesn't feel that different than the urgency of the life critical. You're still going to get woken up in the middle of the night either way, but like for life critical, I mean, you know, it definitely has a feel in a different way. It's just sort of like, hey, you know, a life is relying on you, so that's more important than finances. But your immediate like up and down and like, let's try to get this thing on. Like they're both like very forceful. Like you need to have that sense of urgency. And it's like, if your sense of urgency in life critical is like seconds in finances, it's also going to be seconds. So it's like from that aspect, it's hard to differentiate, but there's definitely a different feel afterwards, you know, how things go. And, you know, if folks are unhappy with how things went, or if there are some consequences there, like, and any large life critical service is going to kind of have that, those aspects of it. And you get somewhat, you know, sheltered from that if you're the person working on the tech side, till you need to maybe go into court one day or something and, you know, defend the company or what happened. So that's, you know, and luckily at that time it was more my boss that had to do that, but it's something, you know, that made it feel, you know, very, very real. But, yeah, I was just going to say, you know, Philips Home Monitoring, they had a service called, it was basically helping elderly folks that they were living alone, they could hit a button and get help. Many people in the U.S. I've fallen and I can't get up.
But, yeah, exactly.
That was their big competitor, and they're actually bigger than them for some period of time. It was rewarding too, because you do every day, you're helping people. So I don't want to, just dwell on the worst cases, but there was a lot of good in there. I think people really felt, positive working there and doing that. But, and Philips Health Monitoring is an idea that's kind of like Philips kind of moved on in their medical healthcare home monitoring. Like they've kind of gone into different directions nowadays.
Yeah, there's a lot of Internet of Things sort of approach to what they're doing, or connected devices. Yeah.
And I think that they were kind of a little early to the idea of home monitoring. Like, if that had coincided with COVID hitting, like I think they would have really like hit a huge chord, but they were about 20 years too early for that.
There was a bike shop around the corner of my house that closed down 1 week before the lockdown hit. And I always think if they had just held on one more week, and suddenly everyone wanted to be outside bicycling.
Yeah.
This is right on the edge. Rob, what do you do to manage stress? Like, do you have personal practices? Any tips for other security professionals? Like, how do you manage it? You've been in, high pressure environments for such a large chunk of your career. What do you do to keep your head up?
I mean, it's like, I'm sort of used to it. And I think it's like part of my personality is like, just at least on the outside, just kind of being very calm and kind of stable, reasonable most of the time. My family, I'm not always like that, and like friends and things, but I think it's, the stress is just something like I've worked in IT operations for so many years now, that's just kind of in your head, part of the job. And, I think of, sometimes I think about like, I like to call them like CISO moments or something. So during the day, you have one or two of these where you're like, no one else in the company is exposed to this or is responsible for this right now. I couldn't deal with this and do something about it. And so those are like sometimes the hardest hitting ones where you're just like, all right, this might be a kind of a new thing. You have to kind of get people together and explain what's going on, explain the risk. Sometimes I think I have like one or two of those a day, keeps the blood running. But, I got a dog about 6 years ago, so that's helped going out on those walks every day. But, exercise is good. Good food, good drink. But, finding times to decompress so that you're not on always all the time. Like, my team knows that I can be intense sometimes, and I'm a bit of a workaholic. I work kind of into the early evenings a lot of time, and they're probably like, hey, will you just cut it out? So I think about that at those times. I'm like, all right, just that's enough. Just stop that and do something else for a bit.
So I'm curious, what's one cybersecurity belief that if you're just scrolling on LinkedIn and it comes across your feed, that you're not going to be able to help but jump into the comments and argue a point?
Well, it's tough to like pick one, because most of the time LinkedIn feels like it's people saying how great their time was with the group they just met with. But sorry, was that editorializing? But
you're not wrong, Rob.
Yeah, the things that I and which is fine. Like, you should enjoy being with your teams. I think LinkedIn is a bit, on the social media side, obviously. And I think this kind of more of a theme, I would say, of like, folks saying like, hey, this new tool or this new thing is going to fix this, your security issues. Like, look, security is about kind of document some boring things like stability, documentation, guidelines, policies, and your operational activities that are sticking with it and metrics. And it's like, if you can't do that stuff, a new tool isn't just going to magically fix all that stuff, right? Like, you need that strong basis. And it's like, so I would say, look, a new tool may not help, but let's say a new method, like let's say passwordless or identity governance that stand on top of like good foundations that, you know, good practices are things that can help your security stance.
Rob, just last question for this sort of section of our talk here, but I do want to ask you about video games. We try to ask all of our guests about it, but you mentioned before you play video games with your children. What kind of games are you playing? Are there ever circumstances where you let them win?
Yeah, well, I was laughing when, like, we had, big surprise, like, there were some pre-questions. I saw that one, but what would he let them win? And it's like, well, I just thought back to this. I was playing Impossible Creatures, which is this 1990s. It's far back there a bit. I don't know. Can't remember how far back, but it's like you merge these animals together, come up with these crazy things, like you basically kind of fight each other. And so I was playing with my kids, and my daughter had to be like 8 or so, or 9 or something. And, you know, after we played a couple times, I was like kind of letting them win. And then we started up the next game. And then, like, before I had even built out all my stuff, like, all these creatures came up and just like wiped out my whole face. It's like, all right. So at that point, I knew, like, there's no more letting them win. Like, they're hurt.
Exactly.
But me win if they feel sad for their old man or something. But we try to play some games. Like, I get into the RPG games a bit. Like, you know, Grim Dawn is a good one. Path of Exile, like, and those are
Path of Exile,
super complex. Like, really, really bright folks that have said, I don't want to play Path of Exile because it's too complex. And it's like, no, you're right. It's like, but it's like, and then this, I don't know, it's like a whole world that people can live in. I don't get into it that much, but I think it could be fun, like, especially the multiplayer aspect of it. Sort of Diablo 4 is another, like, that's a little bit like less brain power and just get in there and just smash everything, and it's fun.
It's awesome. That's good to have balance too, and play some of the older games and then some of the really complicated newer games too. I think that's sometimes I go back and forth between what I want to do. I'm playing a lot of Dr. Mario now, the original NES, because I just that's at the end of the day, that's where my head's at sometimes. But then when larger pieces, getting into some of the more online games. But it just depends on, like, 6 months of one and then 6 months of the other. I think it's good to have a balance.
Yeah. I get less interested in like those kind of quick twitch games where you have to like move perfectly.
Yeah.
Like Mario drives me insane sometimes. It's like, let's go where you slide off the platform. So my son likes to build these levels of Mario and like just builds it, like, especially annoying levels that are impossible, and puts them online. And I go and play through them. He's like, let's see if you can get through this one. I'm like, all right, I got past this thing. Then this, like, you know, something, a big bullet will come out.
Yeah, no bullets. There should be, I'll play, but no bullets, no underwater. No bullets.
Yeah. I don't know. He loves that stuff. He's very good at it.
Well, we'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll have Rob complete our lifestyle polygraph. So stay with us.
You're listening to the No Password Required podcast. We cover cybersecurity and a lot of other stuff.
Welcome back. As many of you know, the lifestyle polygraph is a test used by the federal government to determine if a person is worthy of learning some of our nation's most important secrets. Here, though, we use this technique for slightly lower stakes to determine whether our guests can join our fantasy cybersecurity squad. Rob, are you ready for the lifestyle polygraph?
I am ready.
All right. Question one. Would you be more likely to recommend a career in CISOing to a friend or a foe?
Well, it was a hard choice, but I'd say a friend, because we need good people. We need people that like care about security, and, you know, and I think mentoring folks, like when you get into a position like this, mentoring folks up to that level, even if you end up losing them from your group at some point, like, that's worthwhile. And then you kind of build your network that way too. So I hope more friends will join me here. I talked to my kids about going into security, and they're like, no thanks, Dad.
They've seen what it entails already.
I think they'd be good at it, and the drums, they'd enjoy it, but they have some slightly different interests.
You got to tell them not to do it, and then they'll do it, then they'll want to do it. That's very yeah. Do I be authentic, or do I get my outcome I want? I screw laughs.
I'll think about it. Yeah,
Rob, is it CISO or CISO? How do you like to say?
I always say CISO.
CISO.
Okay. I've heard you were saying CISO before, but I've heard other people say that. And
now we're going with the Rob Hughes pronunciation. I think that's the right CISO.
CISO.
Yeah.
I'm from Boston. Pots and cars, you know.
I say it both ways. I thought both of the ways I say it is wrong, but I think if we have the CISO for RSA, I'd figure we're going to get the definitive answer. We're going to establish it today, Rob. Let's make that the definitive.
All right. Number two, you've never purchased a new car. Can you tell us why, and what would your dream junker be to fix up?
Sure. I tend to get attached to older vehicles. I have this junker that was my second car. My first car got totaled. My second car that I had, it was a 79 Malibu that my uncle gave me. I think it was like a $1 purchase or something. Needed some repair. You know, I was just getting out of college. And, you know, so it's kind of a fun car with a V8 engine. And like over the years, I've, you know, made some improvements to it. Just got fuel injection put into it, which is really great for so much better. It's just amazing.
That's incredible.
It's
still operating, Rob. It's still operating.
Yeah, I still have it. So I won't take credit for putting the fuel injection in myself. That's a little like I like to tinker, but that's probably beyond. Yeah, that would have taken me a long time to do, I think. It's sort of my dream car. Like is probably the, and it's very specific, 71 Plymouth Barracuda.
Ooh.
A few different models, but like I've always loved that car for. It's featured in this movie called Phantasm, and it's like stuck with me as like, hey, that car is cool. And I started looking at how much they cost, even the old ones, and it's like they go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. I was like, 79 Malibu feels like a little bit stubble, but now you can get an electric car that like blows away all the hot rods, and it's like, all right.
I like it when they take an older car and they like bring out a new model of it. You know what I mean? Like they did that with like some of those Nissan Zs. They have like a newer one now of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this cool idea of like, oh, you can still get a Charger that's still a lot of fun to drive.
Oh yeah. The Charger and like the Hellcat edition and I think is pretty cool. And then there's there's a new Toyota Supra that and some Nissan like that are basically like launch cars. You just, you know, put in launch mode, hit the pedal, and like you just take off. Like it's pretty amazing, but not as common vehicles, I guess.
Yeah.
All right. Number three. What is a reality show that you would dominate?
I would say, I think one that would be fun anyway would be like something like Ninja Warrior, but for CISOs. Huh.
What an idea.
I've always liked the look like that show. I'm like, could I do that? And like, just, you know, and I make it like substantially higher odds that I win or get through more of it. It's all peace. I don't know that I would dominate, but you know, I'm sure there's some like real physical type CISOs out there that
it could be like a B-sides village. Like it could be like lock picking, then soldering. Yeah. Then wireless hacking, you know, like you could do it like a series of sort of adjacent skill sets.
Yeah, Ninja Con, but it's like you know, the physical skills, not the I'm a security ninja thing.
Yeah.
I think people make fun of it if it was about the calling your security skills ninja skills.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's the cyber world, they're going to make fun of it for something anyway.
Yeah. No.
Okay, number four. What's one horror film franchise that you think is deeply underrated?
Well, I already alluded to it a little bit, but just Phantasm, which is spelled PH, you know, at the beginning, but it's you know, and look, I was thinking like the franchise, the whole franchise might not be great, but the first movie is just so amazing, it, like in all the wrong ways, and it's just like
right.
You know, it's a snapshot of the time period, right? And it's just these different scenes, and you're like, it's almost like watching The Chair Company today. Just like,
oh my God, yes. Just utterly surreal and like, what is even happening?
Like it's, and I don't know, I love that because that was just, I'm really good, like horror spooky moments that just like, you know, great thematic stuff, like it was original, and I really like that about it. It was great. And the car, you know, that's what that 71 Cuda is from, that, you know, it's like, hey, how much does that one cost? Yeah, some new bucks.
Cool, half a million, no big deal. Okay, final question. We are going to make you the Dr. Frankenstein of cybersecurity. You're going to create a cybersecurity monster to star in a horror film. What characteristics are you giving this monster?
Oh, and look, I don't think this is going to be a very scary movie except for security professionals and IT people, but it's a technical debt, like dripping with technical debt. that speeds up time and changes things randomly. Yeah. You know, maybe an aspect of like, you know, private equity business people coming in and like driving things forward. Like,
oh, they're going to just say synergies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I joke about the business, like you have to have the business empathy. And, you know, I think, but it's really makes it challenging because change happen. You know, as the business changes, you've got to adapt to that. And that's tough. So, you know, this is my Frankenstein.
It's brilliant.
The speeding up of time is a great horror feature, right? Where absolutely. That's the one thing you just want more of, but instead everything's going to happen all the same.
Yeah, like we kind of slow down a little bit so we can get there and patch everything and deal with the technical debt. But it's like, all right, it's next year and you didn't fix that thing still. It's like,
So, Jack, what do you think? Does Rob have what it takes to join our fantasy cybersecurity squad?
He does. Rob passed the lifestyle polygraph. And I think in his room, he could be, among other things, on our fantasy cybersecurity team, he could be our driver and head of car maintenance. And we could expense to corporate a 71 Barracuda for him to work.
That sounds good. Yeah. I'll be the getaway driver.
Yes.
Thank you very much for joining us. If our listeners want to connect with you, learn more about RSA, how can they do so?
Well, we're LinkedIn is probably the best way. I'm on LinkedIn and RSA is on LinkedIn. So we post a lot of things about, you know, not just product, but also just things, you know, guides around identity and password lists, and sometimes we'll do surveys as well. So and I think we get a lot of great feedback on those, so we try to kind of push that thought leadership and intelligence of, you know, around the space we're in, you know, back out, you know, and we do go to a bunch of the conferences, so, you know, if I see you guys there, happy to say hi.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Rob. That brings us to the end of our show. Thank you for listening. For the entire No Password Required team, I'm Jack Klabbe, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks for listening to the No Password Required podcast. Join us next time for more with your favorite cybersecurity personalities. In the meantime, consider liking, subscribing, and sharing this episode. You can find us on social media at No Password Pod. The show is produced by Cyber Florida, and a special thanks goes out to our friends at Carlton Fields and Reality Shift. For more information, visit our website at cyberflorida.org/pod.